you're wrong.
Improperly.
No, they don't know whether or not it was the tailor decided or whether he liked his own cuffs or what, but that combined with the substantial saving of material.
Yes.
Destined the Air Force, you know. At least that's the way I heard it. I don't know.
That's the way those things happen very often, though, I'm sure.
Because they're not written in stone, but...
Yeah. Well, interesting enough, when summer uniforms had cuffs, the winter uniforms never did.
Okay.
Which gives some more validity to what you're saying. If George V had appeared in summer uniform without cuffs, we'd have had cuffless summers as well. I hadn't thought of that. That's good. That's a damn good point.
Let's take a break here, otherwise the parking meter's going to go screwy on us.
Done.
My name is Chris Main, M-A-I-N, and I'm with Major General Edwards. And your initials, sir?
G.J.
G.J. G.J. Edwards, Royal Canadian Air Force, and Regular Canadian Forces. And the date today is 20 June 1979, and we're at Major General Edwards' home in Saanich.
North Saanich,
Dean Park Estates. General Edwards, last time we got as far as you returning to Brandon in April 1941. You just finished your elementary flying school out at Prince Albert, flying on skis in the snow, and you went back to Brandon to take on...
SFTS. Well, return to the Manning Depot in Brandon, Manitoba, in a holding mode, awaiting the opening of. I learned all of this subsequently. Awaiting the opening of number 10 SFTS Service Flying Training School in Dauphin, Manitoba, and I see from my logbook that started flying in Dauphin on the 19th of April, so I suppose we moved in there about a week before, around the 10th or 12th of April, to an SFTS that was in a very, very rough state. The airfield itself was open, the hangars were up, the aircraft were there. But the base itself, the camp itself, was just an incredible mud bath. I remember the roads weren't down in any of the administrative and living areas, and we were walking single file in ruts in gumbo mud. And the risk was that if you fell from this rut. On either side, you may have been lost forever if you didn't have a companion. And of course, the gumbo stick. This is my first experience coming from the east with gumbo in the spring, and it was a salutary experience. We were in H-type huts, large barrack blocks now, very large barrack blocks. And I can't remember the numbers per single room. We were all double bunks. Bunks only perhaps about 2.5-3 feet apart. And it seems to me that our whole course was in one side. So I suppose there would be 60 to 70 of us in one side of the block with the lavatories and the ablution area between us. But I remember the weather was absolutely magnificent. We started flying very, very quickly. And
the Harvard, is that correct?
And this was the Harvard.
Infamous or famous?
to me, at the time, just a terrifying aircraft. Five times as noisy as the old Tiger Moth. A different smell. An all-metal aircraft, a low-wing monoplane, the Yellow Perils, they call them. And one looked at it and wondered if you could ever fly the brute. But looking at my logbook here, I see that I soloed in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in about 6 hours, 6.5 hours, which I suppose was about par for the course in those days. And as it was in the EFTS, if you couldn't solo within a specified time, you were given some kind of a progress and potential check, and a decision was made then whether or not you would continue on the bird. In any event, I did.
What was the first flight like? Now you would was your instruction?
Yeah, first flight I see was an hour and 10 minutes, and that was a familial flight in contrast to the 20 minutes I had on the Tiger Moth only a few months ago. And
now what, you're starting to go up with you and
this was very, very much dual, and it would be devoted mostly to circuits and landings, circuits and bumps, just to get you familiar with the idiosyncrasies of the aircraft. And it had many. It had a great urge on takeoff to swing to the left, and you had to because of the torque effect, you had to watch that very carefully. There was always the risk of a ground loop. A very noisy aircraft, a heck of a lot more power than the old Tiger Moth had. Much better for aerobatics now, but I see I didn't do we did aerobatics just before I soloed. The rest of the stuff was purely circuits and landings and emergency drills. What you would do if you lost the single engine you had and had to shoot a forced landing.
Now, what was their gliding ability like? Was this quite a concern?
Well, compared to the Tiger again, that was my only basis for experience. You couldn't stretch a glide, but it was a stable old aircraft. Looking back, so eventually I instructed on it. So my thinking now would be colored very much by the additional experience I had later.
Now you, because it's correct now, you only flew for 6 hours before you soloed.
6 hours solo, and then I see that I went solo 3 times straight, 6, 7, and 8, sequence of 6, 7, and 8, circuits and landings, round and round and round, all daylight. By the way, back in the EFTS, we did no night flying at all. My first experience with night flying was on the Tiger Moth, on the Harvard, and that much later in this course I was now on. I don't know.
Instruments and things like that weren't
really concentrated upon until you got a great deal more experience.
Now, when you go off on a flight, you would check out the plane and go through your pre-flight check.
Pre-flight, yeah.
And you'd hop in, and then you would have a specific task to do. Is that correct? You just wouldn't hop in and go for a blast somewhere.
No, and we call them sequences. It was a flying sequence that you went through.
What would one of them be like, sir?
Well, your instructor would say, "All right, I want you to go up now and shoot circuits and landings." And here, those sequences were 6, 7, and 8. And you just do that. Go round and round and round, shooting as many as you could. Sometimes you do a touch and go, but mostly it was a full stop landing. And you taxi around back to takeoff point and do it again. And I suppose in an hour you'd get perhaps 5 or 6 circuits and landings in, which was important experience, of course. Get the bird off and...
What about tailspins?
Get
have
the
any?
Confounded back on. Not here, no.
Not tailspins, but ground. I'm thinking
ground loops. No, never did. Sure. Never did until, again, much later, instructing in an Australian managed to give me too damn much rudder on landing, and I couldn't overpower him, and we ground looped into a snowbank.
It was
magnificent. I could have killed that son of a bitch.
Well, what happens? You just no control. It's just the way she goes, or what?
He was. It just broke and ran. if your tail wheel came unlocked, the tail wheel of the Harvard had a travel, I think it was 15 or 20 degrees left or right of center in kind of a locked position. And if you broke that 15 or 20 degree lock, your tail wheel castered, and you had very little control. If you were experienced, you knew what to do with the rudders and the brakes. But if you didn't, you
You have a new braking system now. This is something to get used to.
Oh,
you
know, this was hydraulic. Yes.
Hydraulic, yeah. One each wheel brake.
Individual wheel control, and you had to be careful. If you applied too much brake, you could nose up. Something we weren't worried about on skis and on the Tiger Miles.
Now, would you have brake pedals just above the rudders? Is that
just above the rudders?
So you'd be toe tapping. Is that right?
Yes, but to do it properly, you really had to bring your heels right off the racks below the rudders and put them up high, and you became quite expert at this quickly. But you had to keep your feet sort of suspended out in front of you, and just very gentle braking. And it was something that you were taught, and subsequently I taught students in the taxing sequence, of course, where you learn how to handle. It was a relatively modern aircraft in that sense. You know, it had all the devices on it. As we moved up into more operational aircraft, that kind of system became no more sophisticated than we had on the Harvard at the very beginning.
What about the number of Harvards? So was there a plentiful supply, or do you recall that? Because
I don't recall any shortage of either aircraft or fuel. It seemed to me that we were never stopped. And the old Harvard was a very serviceable bird. As far as I knew then, I was able to confirm this later again when I was instructing, that it required surprisingly little maintenance and just flew and flew and flew.
Now, what was the Anson?
Yep. The Anson or the Cranes, there were Cranes in those days. That was a twin-engine.
That was a twin-engine training and things, or multi-engine training. Now, were there many of those in Dauphin as well?
None in Dauphin. You were either at a single-engine SFTS or a multi-engine SFTS. How we were chosen, I don't know.
And the twain didn't meet. Is that correct?
But we didn't. They didn't mix them, to my knowledge. No, I don't recall a mixed until one got down to the Central Flying School in Trenton, mm-hmm. Where there was a mix of aircraft. These FTSs were single type.
How many planes on at Dauphin do you recall? Approximately how many Harvards and men and things like that in 41?
I really don't know. And I should. If it was anything like St. Hubert, where I instructed about less than a year later, I suppose per flight you would have not less than 15 aircraft, probably more like 20. That seemed to vary a bit, somewhere between 15 and 20, and you could have 4, 5, or 6 flights. So you're talking of upwards to 75, perhaps even as high as 100 aircraft per SFTS. I don't know what the situation was in Dauphin. I was so damn busy as a leading air craftsman learning how to fly and pass the ground school that...
Now, was the ground school more difficult at this time?
Yeah, but we'd progressed to a point where we wanted more. We were learning more about navigation. We were learning more about engines, emergency procedures, airframe engines, navigation. No, that's all I can remember.
What about parachutes?
War parachutes in the Tiger Moth too. Strapped. You sapped your parachute in those aircraft.
Any training on them at all?
None at all, other than here's how to get out of the airplane. Roll it over on its back and poke the nose up if you can. Push the stick forward and it'll throw you out of the aircraft. As you depart, try not to hit or get hit by the tailplane. And that was about it. You were supposed to jump out, count three, and pull the ripcord. But no parachute training at all. And I know of, in that SFDS period, this training period, I don't know of anyone who used a parachute. There were forced landings, but you just stuck with the aircraft.
Well, what's the idea then, since I gather later in operations, that you stuck with your aircraft as long as possible? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Drummed into you then?
Hopefully you had a better chance bringing it down. About the only time we were, as I recall, we were directed jump is if you had a fire in flight. And after activating the fire extinguishing system on a particular aircraft, if you couldn't get the fire out, I'm talking single engine aircraft now, mm-hmm. get out. Later in bomber command, if you had a fire in the aircraft, you got your crew out first, and you went last. But here, mm-hmm. If you're on fire, get out. Otherwise, if the ground looked reasonable at all, try and bring the aircraft down. Not so much, I think, to save the aircraft, but to give you perhaps a better chance of survival. I had a very colorful instructor about a third of my way through Dauphin, a fellow named Sergeant Pilot Reese, who was a Texan. We were seeing an increasing number of Americans in the training system as the course progressed, and I think Reese came in late. And he used to fly, walk out to the aircraft in his cowboy hat with cowboy boots on, which was very impressive to the budding pilot. And Reese knew how to fly. Obviously, he had flown in the States. But he's a little difficult to understand. He had a very Texan drawl. And that difficulty was compounded by the fact that we didn't have cockpit-to-cockpit electric communication. We used to have to talk into a thing called the Gosport tube. Have you heard that expression? The old Gosport? It was a terrible device. It was a flexible tube sprung with a bungee roughly parallel to your mouth, and it had a mouthpiece on it rather like an oxygen mask. And as you and we had this in St. Hubert later as well. It was a long time before we got radio communication between the cockpits. We had no communication with the ground. But this damn Gosport used to hang up, and you had to lean across and shout into the tube to your student at the back or the front, and you give your instruction that way. Well, even with good enunciation and crisp dialogue, it was a damn difficult feat, but with a Texan drawling into this thing, I didn't know what he was talking about most of the time.
Well, where would the earpiece be then?
Well, the thing ended. He could talk to you, you couldn't talk to him. He shouted into this tube, and you plugged into the tube. So in your helmet were two earphones. But they were just the ends of the tubes, if you like, up against your ears. It was a damned system, but mostly it worked because we.
So it was just one-way communication, though.
One-way to communication, and the only thing he said, if I do this or this, that means get out of the aircraft. And I never had an instructor tell me to get out, so that system was never tested in my case. It was a fairly high washout period, discontinued training for the pilot student. A higher washout here than in EFTS. The conversion to this more sophisticated aircraft was just too difficult for some of us. And I've forgotten how many how many of my classmates killed themselves. But this was a much more violent aircraft, and if you didn't treat it properly, it would grab you. And it seemed to me that out of the, what did I say, 60 or 70 students, I think we killed, I think there were killed 8 or 10. And it seemed to me that most of, we didn't hear much about the accidents, you know, they backed and filled immediately, they didn't want to panic the balance of the course, but it would seem to me that most of them were aircraft spinning in, stalling the aircraft at too low an altitude, or crashing on landing, trying to stretch and glide or something, and flicking in. And these aircraft tend to burn. So we buried quite a few. But you knew it was never going to happen to you. You know, you knew, you suspected all along that that particular fellow, as much as you liked him, was not nearly as skillful as you were, and he made a nonsense of it somewhere and killed himself. I mentioned earlier that I'd had no night flying,
mm-hmm.
whatsoever. And here I see we started training in early April, and it wasn't until about the 15th of May that we had our first night sequences. And I had duel for an hour and a 30 with my Texan, Sergeant Pilot Reese. And then he sent me solo for only 25 minutes. We obviously had a chat after that, because he sent me up again for an hour 10. So I now had, I guess, well over 100 hours before I finally flew at night. And it was a pretty terrifying experience. It seemed to me that we did our night flying not at the main field at Dauphin, but at a grass satellite a few miles away. And I don't know why they did their night flying over there. Perhaps they were doing night flying on both airfields, and this was just to get a greater number in the air on a particular night. But the first flight was from flare pots, which we had to help lay. And these were kerosene torches, if you like, only about perhaps about 8 or 10 inches high. And you went out on a field and laid them. If there were runways, you laid them on the edge of the runway. And let's see, that first night, I remember this well. The weather had been absolutely magnificent, and we started our night flying quite happily, but the weather turned bad. And I remember on the second flight of mine, We did our circuits at about 1,000 feet, and you know, just sort of blindly took off, kept the field in sight over your left shoulder. You did a left hand circuit usually, and I remember on that last circuit, I was looking at the field, and suddenly the damn thing disappeared, and I didn't know what had happened. And what had happened was that weather had come in, the ceiling had lowered, and I had flown myself up into the clouds without really realizing it. At this point in time, too, having very little instrument experience, and it was the kind of thing that could very easily have resulted in my crashing the airplane. Somehow I had sense enough to stop the inadvertent climb or whatever I was doing, and got the nose back down and broke out again. Gad, the field was still there. I hadn't done anything silly in the clouds. I was probably only up there for about 15 seconds. It seemed like an eternity. and got the bird down and just couldn't wait to get out of the sky and get landed and report that there were real live clouds up there and far, far too low for our purposes. It was on that night that one of the chaps, in fact, did kill himself at the main field, and I think he wandered into cloud himself, and wasn't as lucky. Yeah, he didn't. Well, know.
What was it with the cloud that I mean? You had 100 hours under your belt.
Yeah.
But a cloud would be enough to freak you in the sense of
at night.
At night.
You see, it was a brand new experience. You were apprehensive enough with this early stage of night flying, because everything pitch black. You can imagine on the prairies, no reference at all, no horizon really, and to wander into cloud as well and not really being experienced with instrument flying. And the ability to know you're in a cloud, to recognize, and then to refer to instruments and go on instruments and then get yourself back down into a visual condition. We just didn't have enough time under our belts to understand how to do that properly. Much later on, as experience was gained in the Commonwealth Air Training Plan, I remember teaching my own students what to do under those circumstances. But at that point in time, I didn't know. I don't think it was an oversight by my instructor. I don't think they were instructing in that particular way. A year later, with much more experience, the instructional technique changed, not drastically, but significantly in areas like this, so that if you did it, find yourself inadvertently in an emergency situation like that, You at least knew the rudiments of recovery. At this point in time, I did not. Anyway, let's see.
What kind of instruments did you have in the harbor, in the sense of?
Well, you had, on all aircraft, you had needle ball airspeed, and you had an artificial horizon that was very easily toppled, and probably not a very precise instrument. It was air-driven, vacuum, pretty fundamental stuff. We had no navigation aids in the cockpit whatsoever. We had no radio compasses or anything like that. And again, no contact with the ground. You when you went up, you were really on your own.
Into your pants flying.
And you watched for lights. Certain lights meant certain things. Flashing Aldous lamps from the control tower meant green meant go ahead, take off or land. Red, of course, was stop. And then you had a series of flashing whites that meant return to airport. What were they now? In any event, that was the control system. There was no radio, no communication with the control tower or the control van whatsoever. Once you got strapped in and started up, you just talked to yourself until you landed back to the tarmac and shut down.
Were you getting any experienced flyers coming back from overseas at this time?
Not yet at this SFTS. Certainly later on, I suppose at all SFTSs, you would have tour-expired air crew coming back.
What was your perception of the war at this time, the air war? You're still in Canada. And
yeah, we heard bits and snatches, but really the average one of us was so preoccupied with getting on with reaching wing standards. It was here at the SFTS that you finally received your wings, that we weren't preoccupied with what was happening really much outside our orbit. It was really a closed world. stayed at the SFTS, I see I had my final wings test on the 15th of June.
1941.
An hour and 5 minutes. And then I see, I we were learning formation flying, this is what it is. And I had a final test on formation flying for 2 hours. I can't remember why they singled out formation at that point in time. But I left the SFTS, and this surprises me, I'd forgotten. I had 95, I had about 110 hours on the Harvard, night and day, most of a day, 95 day and about 10 night. And I see we had, over the period, some 40 hours of instrument flying. So instrument flying, mostly day, was... Again, I hadn't looked at these figures for some time. Rather more than I thought. Than I thought we got. So 95 day, 10 night, and some 40 instrument flying. And I was out of the SFTS by about the 18th or 19th of June. And started my pilot instructor training now at Central Flying School on the 29th of June.
What about your wings parade? Did they have one?
Wings parade.
What was it like?
Must have been a bit of a blur now. I've forgotten who gave us our wings. Can't remember. It was a low key ceremony, but of course a great event for.
Would you be made corps sergeants?
Sergeant pilots. I think perhaps three or four were commissioned on the spot, and these would be the top performers of that particular course. They were made pilot officer, but I would think 90-95%. Sergeant pilot. And how we were selected, some went overseas, not many. You weren't given a choice. You were simply, you were grist, and a few went overseas, but the demand for pilot instructors in the Commonwealth Air Training System was such in June of 1941, that the bulk of us were sent off to Central Flying School in Trenton, Ontario, to become pilot instructors. And we started that course on the 29th of June. I think there was perhaps about a week's leave. This would be the first leave any of us would have had. I joined in October of 40, and here we are June. Mid-June 1941, so what am I saying, 9 months of pretty concentrated training and a very emotional period in the sense of a brand new world. I think we were given a week off at the end of SFTS, and I arrived to start pilot instructor training with about something less than 150 hours flying, quite a bit less than 150, say about 140 hours flying, and yes, CFS lasted, where are we, here we are. CFS lasted from the 29th of June. I see I had a category test. This was to be categorized as an instructor, how good or how bad you were, on the 17th of September. And by the 22nd of September, 5 days later, with a grand total of 215 hours and 35 minutes, I commenced instructing at number 13 SFTS, Harvard Service Flying Training School in St. Hubert.
Okay, now before we get there, your leave, first of all, what did you do when you leave? Did you go home, back to Ottawa?
Back to Ottawa. Seems to me I dropped off. I had cousins as we came by train. All your travel was by train. What did they call them in those days? You were part of a draft on a train. Seems to me that I spent about 2 days in Sudbury, then got on the train again and came to Ottawa. Parents living there, most of my friends there.
Very pleased with you. Or?
Very well, Lord. I was the first pilot in my group, and this was big stuff. Darling, this is Mr.
You're back on, and you're on tape.
No more coffee.
Thank you. So you got off on your leave. You were the first one of your group to be a pilot. Now you would have your wings, and then would you have sergeant stripes on the arm?
And sergeant stripes. And a fair number of my friends, what period, where it was September 41, a fair number had over the summer of 40-41 decided to join one of the three services, and two of my closest friends had decided to join Air Force, and of course were very interested, chapter and verse, and my experiences, what was it like, etc., etc., etc. Both of those lads did earn their wings and were killed in Europe in about 1943. But
how did it feel with this new rank?
Well, the rank didn't mean much, but to be a pilot was the thing.
The wings were important.
The wings were the thing. And of course, you felt so experienced. 215 hours. You were ready to take on the enemy immediately, and most of us disappointed, I guess, with having been assigned to be instructors rather than to go operational. And
I guess the stories would be filtering down about all the kudos won and
exactly
people and awards and decorations.
Awards and decorations and the hot aircraft and how great it was. And no thought of danger or risk really at all that I recall particularly. You were just so excited with having achieved pilot status that you... Yeah, you really couldn't wait to test yourself now to find out just how good you were. You know, you fooled around in these training aircraft, fighter tactics and that sort of thing. No guns, but you just knew that you would acquit yourself with incredible distinction if you ever met the enemy. Subsequently, you discovered that wasn't all entirely true. That,
what about pay now? Of course, you wouldn't have too much to spend it on. You must have been rolling in the dough.
Rolling in the dough. My word, yes. Let me see. I do remember a pilot officer made 6.25 a day. And that, it seemed to me, was $4 pay, 4.25 pay, and $2 flying pay per day. So a pilot officer made less than $200 a month. A sergeant pilot probably made, and I'm guessing now, probably made about $135 a month. And I can't remember what the breakdown of that pay was. But
you had lots, though, is that correct?
Say?
You had a lot of pay left over, though. Is that correct? Because your expenses were all taken care of.
Yeah, but right away, first time you had a few hundred together, you were thinking of buying a car. That was uppermost. We were talking about cars earlier, and it was certainly uppermost then. You wanted that kind of mobility, and I went into debt almost immediately and bought a car. That was a clunk.
What was it?
I think it was a Chev. I think it was about a 1936 Chev that had seen its best days. And of course, petrol was hard to get. Gas,
mm-hmm.
Coupons. But for the you really would use a vehicle only on the weekends. The rest of the time you were tied completely to your. To your flying training night and day, with some ground school instruction as well. So in June to the
this is September or
late
August
late, yeah
I
late
say.
June July August through to the middle of September, learning what we call, I suppose they still call it. Patter, the patter you used, the
banter.
Well, no, it wasn't banter. It was very important stuff. You had to learn chapter and verse. You had to learn chapter and verse how to translate what you were doing with your hands and feet in the aircraft and explain it to your student over this incredible Gosport system. The shouting down the tube into the earphones to the kid in the front or the front of the back. The kid, my word, I was all of was I 20 by then? No, I think I was about 19 and a half by then. Just coming up 20. But a very old man now when I had my wings. And of course even older when I had a student in the front or back seat. But the patter simply said, we're now gonna take off this aircraft. The rudders are centered. The control column is centered. We smoothly apply power, and when we reach, see the flying speed creeping up. When you reach whatever it would be for that particular type of aircraft, 50 miles per hour, gentle back pressure. Keep the aircraft straight. Gentle back pressure on the column. Now you're airborne. That was what patter was. Or if you took them up for aerobatics. It would be, we're now going to dive the aircraft in a fairly steep dive to reach a prescribed airspeed of, say, 120 miles per hour. Now we're going to do a loop, smooth, steady back pressure on the control column. Keep your rudder centered. Pull back. You're now at the top of the loop. Look back. There's the horizon. Keep the wings straight. Now smoothly pull the aircraft through the loop. That was patter. And it was laid down in a book. And you had to learn it with punctuation and the emphasis the way your instructor wanted you to learn it. And it was patter for every one of the airborne maneuvers. And indeed, taxiing on the ground and taking off and landing.
So someone actually sat down, thought this thing out very carefully.
Worked it down and wrote it up.
And wrote it up.
There was a patter book.
And you were to become a human tape recorder.
In effect. But you had to. You what was the term they used? You know, you must say this with conviction and emphasis. There was one other term they used, but it was all part and parcel of the trade of the mm-hmm. of the pilot instructor.
Did the young pilot know what was happening?
That's right.
He knew that you were going through a set routine.
Yes, you would before takeoff. Well, before you got into the aircraft, you would bring your young student under instruction into the briefing room and say, right, today we're going to do this, this, and this
mm-hmm.
in this order. And then you would go out, get into the aircraft, and start the patter associated with that sequence of maneuvers. Even at that early stage, was dull, terribly dull, compared to the compared to the glowing prospects of operational flying. To run through this pattern day after day with your students was trying. There was satisfaction in it, but at age 19, 20, that wasn't the sort of satisfaction you were looking for. And I never did get over that. Right through, I instructed then for after coming out of CFS, I instructed for I guess the better part of 2 years, and found it rather dull throughout. But I wasn't alone. And each month, somebody was being peeled off out of the instructor corps to go overseas, to get on with operational flying. And you hoped that your name...
Could you apply for
your name was coming up.
A lot of jockeying for position and applying for these types of things, or just...
Yeah, if you had... I suspect I didn't have any, but if you had friends in the personnel staff crowd, you could either accelerate or maybe even delay your overseas departure.
Was there any occasion to push those that say we're not that good of an instructor, push them operational to
no.
get rid of them?
It didn't seem to work that way.
So you couldn't screw up on purpose to go.
It didn't seem to work. I think you put your finger on it. If you did that, they right. You serve 6 more months, smarten up, or we won't send you overseas. But after CFS and going to St. Hubert, the big event. Well, the big event there was having your own students, and we had 4 or 6 assigned to us. Per instructor, but I wasn't there too long. Let's see, September 41, Pearl Harbor, December 48, and remember that we had a great many Americans.
September 41.
In 1941.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, we had a great many American pilot instructors in the Commonwealth system. Well, by about January, February, March, I guess it would be, somewhere in there, 1942, the Americans began to, they couldn't recall their Americans in Canada, but they certainly let it be known that they wanted back. And I recall an American recruiting train outside St. Hubert on a siding, and I don't know, some...